Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst with your hosts, Mickey Desai and Susan Cooper. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
Hello again, this is Mickey Desai. I'm one of your hosts for this episode of the Inclusion Catalyst, and I have with me at the table my partner and co-host.
This is Susan Cooper.
We're going to talk to a friend, and what's the official title, Heather?
I'm an assistant professor at American University, and I also direct the small nonprofit Engage Globally.
Uh-huh. And tell us about your dog.
And I have a dog that I cannot get to stop hollering, so let me try that again. That is Ginger, and she is 13 and wonderful and poorly behaved.
Sure. What do you teach? Let's start with a very general sense. What is it that you teach?
I primarily teach in a field called sustainable development or sustainability studies. This is the former a combination of global human development and environmental studies. And the name changed to reflect the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals.
Okay. What does diversity and inclusion have to do with that?
Well, it has to do with it in a lot of ways. I mean, one is whether or not you are teaching in diverse and inclusive classrooms. Mm-hmm. Another is when you're teaching key players or organizations working in the field, are you working with colleagues or are those organizations themselves diverse? And particularly, do they represent the clients that they supposedly serve or work to serve? And then a third category is that inclusiveness applies to kind of all of these issues, particularly as we relate to things like poverty and inequality, as well as the impacts of climate change on global and local communities.
Because one of the questions I had jotted down here was, what does diversity have to do with wildlife conservation? Can you give us an example of what that question tries to tackle?
Absolutely. So wildlife conservation is a great example of where inclusiveness and diversity isn't discussed very often, but it's actually critically important both to the problem and to solving it. So in terms of the problem, most of the wealthiest consumers on Earth tend to be from the Western world, tend to be white, tend to be male, or increasingly tend to be from the elite from China and India. And most of the people who live closest to the wildlife tend to be people of color or what we would call the global majority, and they tend to be extraordinarily poor by global standards. So in other words, if you were talking about something as high profile as elephants, elephant ivory is typically illegally poached in order to send it to elites, often in China or the Chinese diaspora, but others as well. And then elephant ivory is also, or elephants, are also hunted by elite trophy hunters who typically come from the United States and Western Europe, are almost exclusively male and are generally white and quite wealthy. So you can see some inequalities there in terms of who's causing the problem versus who is right next to the problem. And then efforts to try to save those elephants, for example, to protect large forests or to make poaching illegal, immediately impact the residents who are right next door. So imagine if I told you that you had an endangered species in your backyard and then I suddenly appropriated your yard and turned it into a national park. How would you feel about that and how would it impact you? And that's what a lot of people in the world face as we try to conserve wildlife.
Interesting. These are things that I've never really had to imagine in a very up-close sense before. So we do really need to be inclusive with discussions on wildlife conservation. Where do we take the discussion from there? How do you solve those problems?
You know, the first thing is actually to have people like you and everyone else kind of understand that wildlife conservation is about in terms of who's causing the damage versus who's impacted by the damage. And so the first thing is to learn that. The second thing is to recognize if we're lucky enough to be one of those people who gets to go and see that wildlife in person. For example, have you, either of you ever been, say, on a safari or tour a coral reef or even to a national park?
Not on a safari, but I've been to a national park.
Yeah.
If we're lucky enough to be one of those very few people in the world that gets to go to one of those preserved areas, how does our presence help the local people who either sacrificed for that wildlife to be preserved or who are impacted by that preservation process? Mm-hmm. And that's where you start to talk about things like equitable ecotourism. So that's one example. One more would be an example of, say, fair trade products. So if we're importing products from, say, a rainforest, forest or any other type of biological hotspot or area we're trying to preserve, are we paying a fair and living wage to the people producing the products in that setting? And that's where we start to talk about things like fair trade chocolate and fair trade coffee and tea. And there's some ways that you can work to ensure that you're maybe helping the wildlife and the people as opposed to damaging them by those purchases. People listening who want to do something positive, there's this great catchphrase from the Rainforest Alliance called Follow the Frog. And what they do is, first of all, they have a great video online if you're interested. It's quite funny. But they have a certification process for products like chocolate and tea and coffee. And if you see the Rainforest Alliance frog on the product, it means that the product was produced with minimal damage to the environment, but also with positive impact on local community members in the area. And Rainforest Alliance works with some even big players like McDonald's in Europe, and they can really help you make wise purchasing decisions.
That actually is a great segue to something that I was just about to ask, is other than being consumers of fair trade products and products that support specific campaigns like that, what can the average person do to contribute to the cause, whether some people are like full activists, but then some people, they really care about these issues, but they're not necessarily in the activist space. What can the average person do to support these issues?
Sure. So there's a couple of things. The average person to support the intersection of inclusion and wildlife can make wise purchases, again, like the using the Rainforest Alliance symbol. They can really research before they do any type of tourism into any type of wildlife setting, including in the United States. Try to work with reputable, certified ecotourist travel agencies, that sort of thing. The average person can also contribute to wildlife conservation organizations, and particularly to organizations that keep local communities in mind. One of the most well-known and arguably most successful would be World Wildlife Fund and their work in Namibia and Nepal, for example. So when you're donating to conservation organizations, make sure they're talking about issues of inclusiveness and make sure that their staff is inclusive before you make that donation. So those are three steps. There's a whole range of activities people can do individually just to contribute more generally to inclusiveness, but if you're interested in that.
I am kind of curious, you know, we're talking about the need to take a population that likes convenience and asking them to do some rather inconvenient things like research. So how then do you take a normal population and get them to think like activists? And then again, how then do you foster diversity amongst an activist population?
Yeah, so how to get sort of the regular consumer to make changes is one of the core puzzles of this industry, and in my opinion, for the world in the future. And one thing that we can point to actually is the plastic straw movement. So I'm sure you've seen so many cities, states, and countries are now banning plastic straws. Almost all of a sudden sort of came out of nowhere from most people's perspective. Airlines, major companies like Starbucks and parts of McDonald's are banning them. And how that came about was actually a very large activist effort by various organizations, but the catalyst may have been a photograph and video of a sea turtle with a plastic straw up his nose. Did either of you see that? It went viral.
Yes.
Several times. So you both saw it, right? And so one way that we get the average consumer to be interested both in conservation and any other issue is really to tell that story well. So another photo that went viral just last month was a photo from the Virunga National Park in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And it shows two gorillas standing up and posing behind a National Guard. I don't know if you may have seen that one.
No, I have not.
Okay. I'll have to send it to you both. But it went viral, and what it did was it raised some awareness about the issues facing National Park Guards as well as residents near Virunga as we try to save the very small remaining number of gorillas. And a lot of people saw that photo, started Googling Virunga, and then ended up watching what is a fantastic but very difficult documentary called Virunga. And once they watched that, then they were in some ways transformed. So all of that is a long way to say that often we educate the regular consumer by some type of viral photo or video messaging. And then people sort of become aware and it becomes sort of a bandwagon, a peer pressure movement. And then you can get some pretty significant change. The real change, of course, comes when individuals and groups and communities advocate for laws and policies to change. So with many countries now banning straws and single-use plastics, we'll start to see an immediate impact in those countries and their waterways and the trash, but we'll also start to see an immediate impact in the supply chain, and people will start to create alternative plastics. So
alternative plastics?
Yes, plastics made of plant products, plastics that are not plastic. They are compostable products, and we'll start to see, we are already seeing that industry literally being transformed as we speak. In terms of conservation and inclusiveness, the same thing could happen with ecotourism, where more and more people began to realize that tourism can actually have a very negative impact, and those who had a positive impact coming back and telling their friends, and that creates a demand for greener and more human, ethically, more ethical tourism, and tourism that is therefore helpful to local communities and starts to recognize this inclusiveness problem. That answers your question, but...
It does. I think there's simply a lot there to think about. And, you know, ecotourism in particular, the word tourism makes me think of an appeal to people who have money to go on tours.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yep.
And what we want is for those people's money to be shared with the local community in an equitable and in a way that creates human development opportunities and enables local people to choose their own paths forward, as opposed to being trapped in by the conservation going on around them. One small thing local everyone could do, we could all carbon offset our summer travels, no matter where you're traveling and how you're traveling, because one key issue for our future is the inequitable or lack of inclusiveness impact of climate change. So climate change is obviously going to devastate people who are poor, people who are in rural areas, people who are close to coastlines. And we're seeing that today here in Washington, D.C. Of course, this is weather, not climate. But mm-hmm. We did have the hottest June in a recorded time, 120 years of weather recordings in the world this last June. Mm-hmm. And so as an example, the heat wave impacting 138 million people today. How is that different if you can afford air conditioning versus if you cannot?
Right.
And so that's when we start to talk about the intersection of the impact of inequality and inclusiveness and environmental consequences. So individuals can carbon offset their travels, help people plant trees or do other things that enable them to sort of reduce the impact of climate change potentially.
So what are some things other than planting trees? I feel like is that equal to a plane trip across the country? The carbon impact of a plane trip is
sort
pretty
of
enormous. And people also do things like not fly when it's more convenient.
Yep. So great point, Susan. So in parts of Europe, particularly Scandinavia, we're seeing a no-fly movement right now. We even had a major airline, I'm going to blank on which one it was, but out of Scandinavia, encouraging people to take trains this summer instead of flying. So that's certainly a movement in Europe that is not taking off, pardon the pun, in the rest of the world. And so trees are not identically equivalent, but they're better than nothing. And something that's extraordinarily important in the conservation, climate change, and inclusiveness worlds is to make sure that we understand that some progress is better than none. We use the phrase, don't let the perfect get in the way of the good. So if you decide to climate offset your flight, an average flight, we're doing carbon offsetting in my nonprofit, so I've just looked at this. An average flight from New York City to San Jose, Costa Rica will take about 1,000 pounds of carbon. If you plant two trees in 20 years, they will absorb that same amount of carbon. And so it's not perfect. The trees have to survive. They have to be the right kind of tree. Your plane has to have been full. But on an average estimate, if you plant two trees for an international flight, you have made a significant impact in reducing the carbon emissions impact that you had.
That's actually a lot better than I thought. So I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, I practice trying to be carbon neutral using the best estimates available, really just looking online and doing a quick survey. And it costs me on average around $300 to $350 a year. That's a little lower than it might be for most people, but I'm a vegetarian and my office offsets independently. So with those two factors, it costs me around $300 a year to be carbon neutral.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And for those of you listening, if you'd like to be carbon neutral through our program, we're planting trees, excuse me, not we, our local partners are planting trees in Costa Rica to create biological corridors for a variety of birds and animals, and then also in rural Ghana, which is an area very much impacted by desertification. And so you can carbon offset, and our local partners, generally they're teenagers in their environmental education programs, will plant those trees for you and take care of them. So it's a really nice combination of environmental and human impact.
At the end of the episode, I want to make sure we get your contact information, especially for your nonprofit. But first, I want to switch gears a little bit. You know, we've been talking about wildlife conservation and carbon offsets and things like that, but we haven't really specifically been dwelling on climate change. Let's do that for a minute. Let's talk about climate change. Let's talk about getting the average person involved in looking at climate change, and what do we as average people get to do to deal with issues regarding climate change?
Okay, the first thing, if I might quote Greta, who is the now very famous teenager organizing in Europe, the house really is on fire. Climate change is an absolute crisis, and the first thing we need to do is recognize that. It's a crisis in terms of changing the planet. It's a crisis in terms of its impact on biodiversity, but it's also a crisis for public health, and particularly for people who have less resources in the world. So, for example, in the communities that I partner with and work with in northern Ghana, it used to rain twice a year, and now it rains once a year. If you are a subsistence farmer and everything in your world and for your family's lives depends on farming, raining once a year instead of twice a year is transformative to your world. And I'm sure you all can imagine what some of the economic and malnutrition impacts of that are. So the first thing is to recognize that this is an absolute crisis. And then the second thing is to understand that we can act in a lot of different ways. And the first one is to make individual change. People will say to you, well, that's not enough. And it's not in any way enough. But I'm a huge fan of individual change for three reasons. One is that it makes us feel better. And hope is something that we absolutely need right now in the face of the climate change and biodiversity crises. The second is that when individuals change, so do their friends. And that's how we get movements like the plastic straw movement. The third is that individual change actually leads to what we call an opportunity for increasing political will. So the more people who act on something, the more likely our political representatives are to act on something. So individual change matters. And the four biggest things that one can do, don't fly. And if you do fly, offset. Secondly, is to reduce your meat intake, particularly your industrialized meat. So that would include beef and pork and also things like farmed shrimp, as well as industrialized caught fish. A third thing that people can do is actually think about things like total amount of waste that they create and try to reduce their usage of things like single-use plastic, as well as the amount of trash that they throw away, particularly the amount of food waste that they throw away. Americans throw away around 33% of the food that we purchase, and that's a really high number. So those are three key things. In our website and in our blogs, we have, you know, significantly more things that folks can do. Of course, we can reduce our general transit, so try to carpool, take bicycles, and walk if possible. And also turning that air conditioning unit up is critical. A lot of people say if Americans would just turn our air conditioning units up to 73 degrees, it would really matter. For those of us who have more resources, the possibility of installing solar power or purchasing solar or wind power. So here in Washington, D.C., where I live, I use a wind power company, and all of my power is provided through the wind power company, including both my heat and my electricity. And that allows me to significantly reduce my carbon impact. It costs me some extra money, I would say on average, maybe $200 extra a year. And for me, that's very much worth it. So those are some individual things. Beyond individuals, of course, we have to act larger, and that involves things like advocating to our political leaders. But if folks are maybe not finding that particularly effective at the moment, we need to remember that politicians are not the only key actors in the world. So I do a lot of advocating to companies, particularly small businesses in my community, and I will just simply ask businesses if they would be willing to go carbon neutral. And you'd be amazed how rarely people ask. Folks who belong to faith organizations, it's a wonderful opportunity to ask your temple or your synagogue, your mosque, if they would be willing to go carbon neutral, or even do something as simple as plant trees on their property. So there is literally, in my opinion, an endless opportunity for folks to engage in this issue, largely in a positive way.
That's a lot.
It's something we spend a lot of time thinking about.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned that we need to have hope, and that's a lot of things that people can do, that it really does. It gives me hope that people can do something. It's not a hopeless prospect.
It is by no means a hopeless prospect, and we have faced very difficult challenges as human beings before. And to be honest, we started about talking about inclusiveness, and I'm sorry we've moved largely to the environment. But
I asked for it, so.
but we need to remember that we have faced, in this last century, human beings have made what is just unbelievable, extraordinary progress. For example, we have reduced the global poverty rate from in the 1800s, about 80% of the planet, down to around 12% of the planet. In the early 1800s, about 85 to 90% of the people on Earth could not read, and today 90% can. Literally, we have transformed the human development and human welfare of our planet. We've also basically come close to doubling life expectancies in most of the world just in the last 120 years. So if we can have amazing human development successes, then we know that if we focus and we try and we acknowledge the scope of the problem, we can have similar successes on the environment.
Thank you. I think a lot of people need to hear a message of hope, especially these days. It seems dire, but it's easy to give up, right? It seems way too easy to give up, and yet we don't need to.
Exactly. It's very easy to give up, and it's very easy to believe that our individual actions don't matter. But I'm going to come back to my tree example. Paying for someone to plant two or four trees to offset someone's summer travels seems something tiny, but there's some things to remember. One is, how empowering is it for a young girl in a rural farming setting to be able to plant a tree? That's number one. And the second is, what will that tree actually do? And in addition to absorbing around 20 tons of carbon in its lifetime, that tree will house species. And one tree in the rainforest that we work in Costa Rica, they actually counted the number of species on that tree, and it was 1,250 different living species.
Goodness.
And so one tree matters. And one of my favorite quotes, Jane Goodall, and she says, there's still a lot left worth fighting for. And there's an enormous amount of biodiversity and life worth fighting for, including our own and including our own public health. And that's why we have to act as much as we can and not believe that our actions don't matter.
We've got a limited amount of time left, but Susan, you have anything you wanted to touch on before I drop these last two questions?
No, go for it.
Okay. You know, I'm reminded, and you just reminded us, that we're in a much better position now. We're in much better human shape now than we were, say, 150 years ago. So why do things, my first question is, why then do things seem so dire now? And maybe related to that is, can we take a look at the communication strategies or whatever tools we need to improve our efforts overall? We've sort of touched on them throughout this conversation, but let's do a quick summary before we wrap up the episode.
Sure. So why things look so dire right now is obviously very, very complicated. One is that in the United States, we certainly face political divisiveness that we have not seen in some time, and for many of us have not seen in our lifetimes. And that can be both stressful and depressing. A second is that in some areas, there has been a downturn in human development in just the last few years, particularly the conflict areas. A third is that we have constant access to global news now, so we know all of the problems that we did not know in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and so we're much more aware of the problems than we used to be. A fourth is that very few people study the successes. For those of you interested in doing that, I would urge you to read Bill Gates' annual letter to the global community, and also Melinda Gates' recent book, The Moment of Lift. And the Gateses do a fantastic job of focusing on the positive and what has been achieved, and and their data is obviously excellent, so it, you know, you can believe what you read. And then finally, I would say in our public education systems, we're not spending a lot of time talking about global human development, and it's unfortunate. I think we actually need a curriculum on that, as well as a curriculum on environmental science. Really, finally, though, Mickey, the human development news is, as a long-term pattern, outstanding, but the environmental news is correspondingly devastating. And in the environmental world, we are commonly using phrases like apocalypse at this point, the sixth extinction, and other phrases to try to help people understand how vast the devastation is, both by climate change and then separately from biodiversity collapse. So I think that is one reason people feel depressed, because in fact, this field is depressing.
We're going to end on that note.
Well, let's not end on that note. Let's end on what you can do, and let me share. So I run a small organization called Engage Globally. I would like to be clear that my words are mine alone and do not represent my university or my nonprofit. But if you are interested in learning more about our work and would like to offset your emissions or help us with our human development programs, particularly girls and women's education, we'd love to have you visit our website at www.engageglobally.org.
Fantastic. Thank you, Heather. And I'm hoping we can revisit again, because it seems like there's plenty more to talk about in terms of wildlife conservation and climate issues as they relate to diversity and social justice.
I would love to. And I'm also happy to talk very specifically about inclusiveness and social justice in the classroom as a separate issue.
Let's definitely make some plans to do that. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.